Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Marie. Hi, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Hi, General. Det är fantastiskt trevligt att vara här. How are you?
I am great. I am so excited to finally get to talk to you. For those of you that follow the show on our network site, findwaterpodcast.com, Marie is a frequent commenter on episodes, and they are always the comments are always in depth. They're always very funny. They're always very insightful. And I look forward to every single one that you leave. And you've been doing it for years now. And I have been sort of, I don't know, I think we've danced around you coming on the show finally. But now when we got to, because you are in Sweden right now, is that right?
Yes, I am in Sweden.
So yeah, you finally realized, well, here's the perfect time to talk about a Swedish-centric episode of MASH, which of course is episode 16, as Hawkeye would say it, Inga. Which originally aired on January 8th, 1979. So I can't wait to get to this one with you. But of course, we have to start at the beginning. This is your first time on the show. How do you become a fan of MASH all the way out there in Sweden?
Yes, all the way over here. Well, it started a very long time ago. For me, MASH actually started with a theme song. And that sounds like a stupid thing to say, because of course MASH starts with a theme song. But I know I'm not the only person in this world who had the experience of being a child and lying awake in your bed and just hearing da 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 da, da coming from the living room. And there I was in my bed, and I heard the song, and it just spoke to me. I had no idea there was a show called MASH. I had no idea what it was about. But it was something about that melody that just resonated with me. We have this thing in Sweden that we call the svenska vemodet, the Swedish melancholy. And it's basically just the sense of longing. You long for things gone, long for people gone, or you long for things that maybe will be there someday. And it's engraved into our Swedish souls and have been for generations. And I mean, we live in this sparsely populated country where it's cold and dark for a huge chunk of the year. And it does something to you. It brings out the vemod, the melancholy. And there is not just a sad feeling, there's a great beauty to it too. And this melancholy certainly permeates the MASH theme song. It is, and the whole show is just, it's filled with longing, you know, people longing for the war to be over, to go home to their loved ones, or to find love, or to just make a difference. So we kind of clicked right away there, the show and I, even before I had seen a single minute of it. And then one day I was old enough to actually watch it, and I loved it. And I watched it with my dad, and I loved how much he loved it. And it was this great, great thing that we shared. And as I grew up, I kept watching it. This was first shown here in 75, I believe, and this was like the late 80s, so it was the reruns, but I loved it, and I kept watching it in my teens and my early 20s, and it was always like checking in with old friends, basically, and Margaret was always my favorite character. And I remember being in my early 20s, I took a lot of singing lessons back then. And I used to wear my hair up in a high bun like Margaret does. my vocal coach back then used to tell me to aim for the bun when she wanted my high soprano notes to soar. and soared they did. So MASH made me a better singer. And that's something.
That's amazing.
And then, you know, life went on. And actually, Mash and I sort of fell out of contact with each other for a long, long time, for a couple of decades, actually, which is a horrible thing to say, but it's true. It wasn't on any station I could access anymore. And I was just busy living, you know, working and going to university and working some more. And it wasn't until right at the beginning of the pandemic, actually, and the world was just turning into this very, very weird and scary place. And I came home from work one day and sat down in front of the TV, and there it was. Mash, my old friends were there again, and it was honestly like falling in love, just head over heels. It was just what I needed in that exact moment in my life when everything was so weird and scary. It was very helpful to see these amazing, beautiful, problematic, flawed characters struggle with their scary reality, and it was really helpful, and it made me feel less lonely. And and this time around, when I watched it with my adult eyes, I truly started to appreciate the writing on the show, because when I was younger, I used to read the subtitles, and you know, was happy with that. It was what it was. But this time, I really started to listen and actually truly understand what a clever and remarkably well written show it is. So it was truly a great discovery all over again. And the beautiful writing and the gorgeous acting actually inspired me to be a fanfic writer. I started to write MASH fanfics, and I never expected that to happen. And now it's like my favorite thing to do in my spare time. So I'm really, really happy that I got to fall in love with this beautiful, perfect show twice in my life.
Wow. Please tell me that fanfic is online somewhere. Please.
Yes, it is.
Oh,
it for sure is.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, I got to read some of that. That's really cool. Margaret takes over the 477. It's funny. I'm always surprised when I'm speaking to someone from a very different culture, and then they talk about that they fell in love with the show. And I don't know why I am, because the whole point of it, of the show being, a good show or a good movie, is that it's expressing a common humanity across cultures. And so it should work. But this does seem such an American-based show that I'm always just continually surprised that people fall in love with it, that your parents loved it so much, and that you loved it so much, even though it is so steeped in American culture and American culture of the past, and yet it still resonated with you. And that, again, it just says something about the show, that the basic decency of the characters and what they're going through is so relatable that it just transcends all that.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the themes of MASH with this longing and this being caught in this terrifying situation, it's just whenever, wherever you are in your own personal life, you can always find something in the show that suits that situation you are in. So it truly works on so many levels.
You mentioned that the show, when you watched it as a kid, it had subtitles. Was that right? So yes. there was a Swedish dub of MASH? Is that how that worked? You had Swedish actors dubbing the characters?
No, we don't. We just have subtitles.
Oh, okay. So they were speaking English and it had English subtitles. Okay.
Yes,
all right.
We do very little dubbing over here, actually.
Okay.
Usually always subtitles and not Swedish actors. Thank goodness.
I love the idea of Swedish actors doing the MASH line.
It would be so weird. Oh my goodness. I can't.
How would one say ferret face in Swedish? You know, like, what would that sound like?
Yeah. Iller ansikte.
Ooh, very cool. All right. One other thing you mentioned about the theme song being so, resonant in your mind is that it's funny you mentioned that, because just a couple of days ago, a friend sent me a TikTok that somebody made, and I'm not on TikTok, so they sent it to me. The only way I would see it is if somebody sends it to me. But it was a guy about my age who said he was like playing TV theme songs, and he said, This, once you heard this, kids of a certain generation, you knew it was time to go to bed, and it was Suicide Is Painless. And he knew that, like, okay, it's getting later in the evening, time to go to bed. I don't get to.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, he was like, he hated the song because he knew it was bedtime. It's not the song's fault. But for his parents, it was like, oh, MASH is on, time to go to bed. Like, oh, all right, you know. So, da, 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 da. Oh, yes. All right, okay.
Oh, my goodness. Theme song to bedtime, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thing before we get to this episode is, have you seen the movie, MASH?
I have not, no.
Okay.
I own it. It came with my DVD set, but I have not watched it yet.
Okay, well, the movie has the opening theme of Suicide Is Painless has lyrics. It plays lyrics, and it was written by Robert Altman's son, and in the years since, he has kind of disavowed it and said it was a stupid song, and he just kind of tossed it off, and it's made him a ton of money. It's funny, fun fact, he's made more money off of MASH TV series than Robert Altman ever did, because they use the theme song, and he continually gets paid for that, as opposed to Robert Altman, who just made the movie, and his financial participation is limited to, I guess, some level of, I don't know how all this stuff works. But anyway, the son has made way more money because, of course, the show's still playing. But anyway, the movie features lyrics, and I actually find the opening to that movie with the song to be quite beautiful. Contrary to what Mr. Altman might think of the song, I actually think it's a really beautiful song. And a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went to a repertory theater, and they were showing MASH as a tribute to Donald Sutherland, the late great Donald Sutherland. And it's one of those theaters where there's like couches, and they have waiters come by and bring you food, and it's a little more of a kind of a deluxe kind of experience than a typical movie theater. And so before the movie, we ordered our food, and all I could think about was, I just don't want the waiter to come back with the food while the theme is playing, because I love this opening so much, and I don't want to be interrupted. And of course, that's what happens. They came by and stood in front of us, and as he's like putting down our food, I'm like kind of looking over his shoulder, and I'm just trying to pay attention because I love the opening so much. And I was just like, oh, I could have waited another 45 seconds to get our pretzel and popcorn, but okay, that's fine.
Oh, darn it, pretzels.
So anyway, well, yeah, that's wonderful. That's great that you were able to reconnect with it at, you know, like sort of exactly the right time
for people. Yes, it was magic. Simply, it was what I needed in that exact moment, and what the world needed in that exact moment. You know, the world needed a lot more humanity, and it still does. So
we still do, we still do. okay, well, let's talk about Inga. As I mentioned, it originally aired on January 8th, 1979. It was written and directed by Alan Alda. Hawkeye is excited over the news that a visiting Swedish doctor named Inga Halvorsen will be arriving that night. In the showers, he tells BJ and Winchester that he is sure he will be irresistible to Inga, which he says lustily. Dr. Halvorsen arrives, and Hawkeye is at his most flirty, escorting her to the VIP tent, carrying her suitcase. Winchester tries to horn in, but he goofs when he makes a crack about how lumpy older Swedish women can get. Realizing he's made a horrible faux pas, he excuses himself, leaving Hawkeye and Inga to laugh collectively. Hawkeye and Inga meet at the swamp, and Hawkeye thinks it's a date. Inga is there to talk medicine, which disappoints him. He blows out the candle he lit, turns off the romantic music, and his tone is one of frustration. The next day, in OR, Inga shows herself to be an excellent surgeon, showing Hawkeye and the others a procedure that none of them have ever seen before. Later, in the mess tent, Winchester pokes and prods Hawkeye, insisting that he was put off by Inga taking over for him. At first, he says that's ridiculous, but after a little more prodding by Winchester, Hawkeye vents about how he didn't like how Inga took over, not that she did it at all. That enrages Margaret, and their argument spills out of the tent. Hawkeye thinks Margaret is jealous, which seems like a reach, to say the least, but Margaret is mad that Hawkeye seems to only judge women by one standard, and meeting a woman at his surgical equal is something he can't handle. Later in the swamp, Inga shows up to apologize, but Hawkeye tells her that's not necessary. She even starts to respond to Hawkeye's advances from the night before, kissing him and leaning him back on his bunk. Hawkeye, thrown off by her aggressiveness, stupidly asks, "When you dance, who leads?" This kills the mood, and Inga, hurt, leaves. Hawkeye marvels at his own idiocy. I did it again. I did it again. This kicks off a sort of philosophical argument about men and women in the camp. Klinger expresses support for Hawkeye, but BJ and Potter try and show Hawkeye that being in an equal partnership with women is the way to go. In post-op, a patient of Winchester's has a severe allergic reaction to some medication, and he thinks his solution is a tracheotomy. Inga happens to be there and suggests another, less intrusive way. Winchester argues with her, but when Inga's method turns out to be effective, Winchester is miffed. He sarcastically thanks her for correcting him and walks out. Hawkeye, BJ, and Winchester talk about it in the swamp, and Winchester is furious at Inga, calling her pushy. Hawkeye, listening to all this, realizes what an ass he himself has been and goes to Inga's tent to apologize. He finds her upset over what happened, hurt over the idea that she was supposed to let a patient suffer just over protocol. Hawkeye reassures her that she did the right thing. Hawkeye notices the music Inga has on, and Inga suggests that they dance to it. Inga has to teach Hawkeye the dance, meaning she has to lead. It takes Hawkeye a few tries to get it right, but he finally relaxes and lets Inga lead. The dance ends in a passionate embrace and a kiss. The PA announces incoming wounded, and Hawkeye suggests picking up where they left off. But Inga says that she has to report to another unit in a few hours, meaning this is their last private moment together. Hawkeye is frustrated at his own stupidity, but Inga reassures him and suggests that she'd like to see him someday after the war is over. Hawkeye agrees, and they both walk out together, prepared to go to work as equal partners. All right, Marie,
yes.
you knew this episode was coming down the pike, as you were bringing, so you said you wanted to talk about this, but we're going to go through it beat by beat, as we do. But, you know, can you remember what your first reaction was when you got to this one, since it's so kind of, you know, zeroes in on your particular corner of the world?
Yes. You know, when I first watched it, I think I was mostly thrilled with the fact that they said Sweden so many times. And it's just, it is this fun, great thing to have your beautiful native country mentioned so much on your favorite show. It really is. But just, if I step out of my Swedishness and just look at the episode as a whole, I have never been that huge a fan of it, actually, up until now, when I knew that I would be talking about it and I got to dig a little deeper into it and actually study it a bit more. And I think it has a lot going for it. And I know that it isn't one of the most popular episodes out there, but it certainly has many, many good sides. So it has actually, apart from the Swedishness, it has actually grown on me quite a bit for the story itself.
It is certainly an episode that is a signifier of the later seasons of the show, because you could have never done this in the early seasons. I mean, Hawkeye at the very beginning, the opening scene where he's in the showers, he's being such a, I don't want to say pig, but he really is just sort of regarding her as this conquest that is in his mind in the bag already. And it's like, you know, now it's Hawkeye and we've come to know him, and we know that a lot of this is kind of hubris for his own sake, and he's sort of performing for the guys because as a BJ and Winchester show up, so he's being a little cheeky about it. But at the same time, you're like, geez, man, you are. I've said this on other episodes. If I had 1/100th of Hawkeye's sexual confidence, I probably would have done really well in life, but I just don't have it, because he just goes through life thinking he is. I mean, I love when he's like, he gets riled up and he's like, I am sex itself, gentlemen.
Yes. You know, oh, my goodness. Like, that's so uncomfortable. And it certainly makes his standpoint clear for the rest of the episode, you know, where he is on the food chain, if you will. You know, he is the alpha, he is the leader. And I wonder if that will possibly come back to bite him somehow later on.
You think so? I mean, and I love that. I kind of like it a moment that both BJ and Winchester are kind of in league with each other. Like, they're kind of, you know, they're, because at one point after Hawkeye goes on that rant and BJ pulls up like a towel over himself, he's like, I'm not taking my clothes off until he leaves.
And I really like that. I like every time we see that BJ and Charles are sort of, you know, teaming up and being a little bit more friendly. It's really sweet.
I'm always a sucker for Winchester kind of becomes part of the Three Stooges, you know, even if so briefly. It's always just fun that he lets himself kind of become one of the guys just for a moment. Because, I mean, he'll pull himself out of it. But just for a moment, he's kind of like, oh, OK, going along with this sort of nonsense. So, OK, so the stakes have been set. We know Hawkeye is just, you know, he's regarding this woman. He hasn't even seen this woman. And he's already just assuming, like, OK, this is what this is going to be. So then Inga arrives. She is played by Marriott Hartley, who just was on tons of television, tons of movies. She was in Hitchcock's Marnie. She's in Ride the High Country, a really terrific Western. She was on one episode of The Hulk, the Incredible Hulk TV show. For some reason, I watched that show and I was like, oh, wasn't she like a semi-regular? No, she did one episode. She was on Columbo, Little House on the Prairie, Barnaby Jones. The thing she is probably most famous for people of my vintage, let's say, play way to put it, is in the 70s, she did a series of TV commercials with the actor James Garner from the Rockford Files, where they pitched Polaroid cameras. And they did so many commercials together, and they had such chemistry that people thought they were really married. They thought they were a couple in real life. And it went so far that they would walk around apparently with t-shirts, wearing t-shirts that said, "I'm not James Gardner's wife," or "I'm not Married Hartley's husband," or something like that. People were so, I mean, people are insane in America. Like they don't, you know, they see commercials and they just think, oh, that's what reality is. But that's kind of what she was most famous for, at least for me. And she's still around. She's still working. I found a very curious detail in her IMDb profile. It says that Married Hartley was raised in accordance with the principles espoused by her behavioral psychologist grandfather, John B. Watson, who believed that children should neither be held or cuddled.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my God. No wonder she became an actor. Like, it's like she needed some sort of affirmation about herself. Like, that sounds horrible. Like,
Yes,
what's
and
the.
like step into another body that gets to experience all these things. Oh my goodness.
Oh my God. I'm surprised Mary Hartley didn't grow up to be a serial killer. Like, what is that about? Like, oh, John B.
Exactly.
Watson, buddy.
Oh
Whew.
my goodness. And she has this warmth about her. So it's, oh, that's
Yeah,
interesting.
she always has. So as she arrives, I just want to let's get it right out of the gate. What is your opinion of Mary Hartley's Swedish accent?
I actually like it. I think she does a really good job. You can sort of tell that her English comes from a different source, but it's very subtle. She doesn't go like this and make a mockery of a Swedish accent. But Swedish is kind of a sing-songy language when you speak it, and I think she has found little notes of that, a little bit of Swedish glitter to her English, and I like it a lot actually. There will be in a later season there will be another Swedish character appearing, and he sounds a lot more German to me. So I am in favor for her version of a Swedish accent.
Good. Okay, that's good. That's
Yes.
good. Yeah, I mean, she was a perfectly fine actress. Not perfectly. That sounds like it's like a pejorative. No, she was a fine actress. So it makes sense that you studied it and did really well with it. So that's good. I'm glad to hear that that doesn't, to your ear, it doesn't sound discordant or anything like that.
No, it
So.
is really good. And she does, we will hear a couple of times when she goes, yeah, actually. And that, I find that very sweet because that is something people tend to do when they try to mimic a Swedish accent. And I don't know, I have never heard any Swede actually do that and just keep their yaw in their English. But it's a fun, cute little thing, and it helps with the melody, so it's absolutely fine. No.
Okay, good. It's not the she's not doing the Swedish Chef from the Muppets or anything like
Not
that.
even a
Again.
hint of Swedish Chef.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you expect more from MASH, of course. So she's met by Klinger, who is in one of his finest outfits. He's even got a tiara on.
Yes,
And
he looks like a 6-year-old who dressed up like a princess ballerina. It's very cute.
So they start talking, and she takes him in, and she immediately kind of assesses the situation, or as she thinks she is, and she says, "Well, there's something we could help you with." And she says, "I have a colleague in Copenhagen who does sex change operations." And Klinger's just like, "Yeah, what's that?" "Well, you would finally be transformed into a woman." And Klinger's, "What? It's a very sophisticated surgery, but it's possible." And then he's like, "You mean somebody would take a knife?" And of course, he's horrified by all this. Now, we should mention the first female to male surgery was Christine Jorgensen. It was a kind of relatively famous case in the 50s. But the first male to female was 1966. So Dr. Halverson is a way ahead of the curve here when she's talking about this. The thing I love about it is how immediately accepting she is. She has just met this person and she's just like, well, you clearly, wrongly, but she's like, you clearly want to be a woman. You think of yourself as a woman. And so we can help you with that. And there's something so beautiful, even to this day, we're living through it right now. The complete intolerance of chunks of people regarding this kind of thing or what they think is this thing. Sometimes it doesn't even need to be that thing and people get mad about it. But I just love that Inga just meets him and says, well, yeah, we can help you with this. There's just something so beautifully accepting about it that it's really sweet.
Yes, I think so too. It's really great to see that she's open and like, oh, of course, this can happen for you if you wanted to. That's great. Very Swedish of her. Very accepting.
Yeah, I love it. Now, he also mentions that to get out, he needs two doctors to sign a form.
Yeah.
It's always been three. What's the two? What happened to the two? Because if it's only two, he's got two in the bank. What's he talking about?
So. Right. Why isn't he on his way home already? Come on.
Okay, BJ would sign that at a moment's notice. So, yeah, that doesn't... Yeah, that's a weird... You would think that that Jamie Farr, the actor, would say, wait a minute. I've been saying three for like four seasons. What can we change this? But who knows?
Yes, let's move it up.
So Hawkeye comes out and he takes over for Klinger and he's immediately, doing the whole, and he kind of laughs when she says her name and she's like, did I see something funny? And he's like, no, I just love the accent. And he's just, he's just laying it on way, way too hard. And then they go to the tent and he says there's hot and cold running rodents and he turns on all the lights and stuff. And I don't know, what's your take on this as a, what do you think about Hawkeye, the way he's acting here?
Well, he is certainly letting her know that he is interested. And she seems to be kind of charmed by him, too. They're both, he does this little giggle when they go inside the tent and she giggles, too. And it's kind of sweet, actually, so far. I have to say he's charmed by her and she is obviously not too put off by his behavior so far. And this little part of the love story works for me, which will be a problem for me later on. And I have to say that I think this episode could have been really interesting if it hadn't been a beautiful blonde surgeon stepping out of the car, or it could have been a beautiful blonde Swedish surgeon. But what if Inga had been in her 60s, and not a love interest for either Hawkeye or Charles, and they would just have to have interacted with this woman who is just as good as they are on a professional level but have no romantic interest in. I think it would have been a very interesting way to look at another dimension of a wounded male ego. But it is what it is. And so far, I think it's kind of cute.
Okay. One of the things I do like about this episode is that there really is no B plot. There's no kind of silly B plot. It's the whole episode is about this, which I've always liked. I like when they wrote a story that has enough of a, enough material to it that they devote all 24 minutes to it. So that was cool.
Me too. I love these kinds of episodes. Even though we won't see a lot of Klinger or Father Mulcahy or Colonel Potter, I always love when everyone is involved in the same storyline. It's my favorite episodes.
Winchester arrives and tries to kind of horn in on Hawkeye. And he, I think kind of, he's maybe a little more on Inga's wavelength in that he's got this nice bottle of wine and he seems a little more erudite, certainly, than how the full court press that Hawkeye's doing. So Hawkeye senses this and I'm not going to say he sabotages Winchester because he doesn't, but he knows what buttons to press for Winchester, and he does it because then he says, Charles loves the Swedish people, don't you, Charles? And he's like, with a passion. Many's the time he told us about Christina. And he's like, remember Christina, huh? And they're like, ha, 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 ha. And they're doing this right in front of Inga, which is, and then you see even Inga kind of lower her head, kind of embarrassment. And then he talks about that she worked you know, at their home, rosy cheeks, buxom, devilish personality, drove me wild as a teenager. And then he ruins it by some course later. I got to look at her mother when she came to visit. You know how Swedish, lumpy Swedish women can be later in life, which is just spitting hot game there, Charles.
Yes, Charles, my dude, come on.
It's one of those things. I love that it, and then it goes across his face and he realizes what he has just said and he tries to save it.
Yes, and it starts out really well for him. You know, he does this little speech about the wine and he's being sort of poetic and he's like, ah, yes, I'm so in. And he talks about Sweden as the jewel in the crown of Scandinavia, which is correct. But he's so happy with himself and so sure that she's going to be so into him. And then it just falls apart spectacularly. And I love it. I love his face when he realizes what he has said there. It's so funny.
I love when he tries to extricate himself and Hawkeye just mutters, too late now.
And I also, I really like this side of Charles that we get to see here, that he talks about Christina, the maid's devilish personality. And I love that he seems to have this attraction to wilder women, if you will. I mean, we know he had a little thing for Margaret when he first arrived, and she's, you know, a firecracker. And as the show go on, we will see that he tends to be drawn to women who are very unlike him and, you know, the proper Winchester upbringing he has had. And I think it's just nice to see that he's drawn to this wild and free and spirited women. It's a nice little detail to Charles.
He's got a type. He's got a type.
Yep.
So then Hawkeye and Inga have a nice laugh about it, which that scene, by the way, was always cut in syndication. I never saw that scene until the DVDs.
Oh, no.
It was. Yeah. Yeah. It always ended with Winchet with too late now. That thing. I never the scene of them laughing, which is sweet because there's nothing that brings people together, unfortunately, than having, for lack of a better term, a common enemy. And so it's like they both can laugh about what an absolute creep would just do us in that moment. So he's actually really helping Hawkeye with this.
Yes, absolutely. He's a great wingman without knowing it.
So but Hawkeye comes back to the swamp and he says, I persuaded Inga to come over here and join me for a little doctor talk. Winchester, of course, is, you know, furious. And he says, you know, he tried to. You know, he said, Fraser Pierce was more attracted to me, but you began assassinating my character. BJ is like assassinating his character. And then Hawkeye says, yeah, I let him talk, which is.
It's so great. I love how he has just stood there and just watched Charles dig a hole for himself. It's so good. Oh, love it.
So BJ is busy like knitting something and Hawkeye wants to get the swamp ready and he's got a candle and he's and then he talks about what music should I play. And BJ suggests a piece by Bach. And Hawkeye's like, is that really romantic? And BJ says, you ever seen my baby pictures? Which is great. And I love this whole bit because Inga comes over and BJ, of course, has to amscray. And he won't. He won't do it. And he's doing it just to troll Hawkeye. And I absolutely love it when they kid each other like this, where he can... You know, this is the way that two really good friends can operate.
Yes.
Where Hawkeye desperately wants BJ to leave. BJ knows Hawkeye wants him to leave, but he just won't do it. I love that he just digs the knife in on Hawkeye.
I love it too. I love their relationship. This is they're just this great friendship, brotherly thing they've got going. Just teasing the it's great. I love it.
Yeah. And of course, BJ is being effortlessly charming because he's not trying to romance her. You know, I mean, he's just being, you know, he talks about it. He says when she notices that he likes to sew and she says, I like to sew to keep, you know, my fingers nimble for surgery. And he says, oh, that's funny. I do surgery to keep my fingers nimble for sewing. And so he's just being very, very charming. And, you know, she's having a good time. And poor Hawkeye's just like, okay. Yeah. It's great. It's great. I love it so much. And then he makes up Hawkeye makes up a story saying, well, BJ's feeling a little under the weather. And then of course BJ grabs that. He says, well, geez, with this throat thing, I should probably stay in bed.
And Inga wants to help right away, you know. Oh, I have a Swedish remedy for that.
Yeah. Oh, I just love it. So then he puts on the music, and we could see that Inga, first of all, Inga is, they have dressed her in the dowdiest manner possible, right? She's got this giant medical book. She's got this shirt that's buttoned up to her neck. And then she's got this sweater and a skirt that looks like it's made from maybe like a burlap sack. So it's like, she's clearly not here for romance, and Hawkeye is not paying attention.
Yeah, that's true. I was thinking about her skirt. Like, that is a really ill-fitting skirt they choose for her there. But okay, fine.
She's wearing material that my old Uncle Fred used to wear, and he was born in 1905. You know, so I mean, well, actually, that's a contempt. This is about when they would be around the same age, I guess, at this point, when the show is set. But I mean, clearly, she's not here. She's clearly not here for this, and he just is not listening. And you talked about that you watched the show as a child, right? And then you watched it later on as an adult, and it reads differently, of course, as you get older. And as a kid, as a young boy, we are, in America at least, we are fed tons of popular entertainment where the male hero is really, really bullish about trying to romance somebody. And as a kid, you don't perceive that there's anything wrong with that, you know, because that's just how it's sold. It's like, well, he's your hero, and he's trying to romance this person, and what's the deal? And then you get older and you go, whoa, okay. And so watching this scene over again, obviously I've seen it hundreds of times in my adulthood, but watching it again for the purposes of this episode, it really does. There is a point where she clearly lets him know, this is not here for this. And he still isn't really paying attention. And that is where I'm like, he's really being a creep. And considering this was written and directed by Alan Alda, this is entirely intentional. But it's funny that as a kid, I would not have picked up on that. And now I'm like, oh, Hawkeye, geez, buddy.
Yes. Except when he starts to talk about her ears and things. Yuck. And but that's true. When you watch a lot of older shows, like Cheers or whatever, things you absolutely did not pick up on as a child, and it's just super uncomfortable now with the it's like it's sexual harassment a lot of the time. And we just back then it just flew by, and it was just men being men and doing manly things. And it is really hard to watch sometimes.
Yeah, I remember many years ago, I took a nephew of mine to go see Goldfinger, the James Bond movie, on the big screen. And I hadn't seen, I love James Bond. It's, you know, it's James Bond. But I hadn't seen Goldfinger in a while. And, you know, he was about like 11, 12 when I took him to it. And there's a scene in Goldfinger that is, way out there in terms of sexual politics. And I remember just thinking like, you know, and I was like, okay, when the movie's over, I'm going to explain to him, it was made in the 60s. this is not cool. And so,
Yeah. And this whole thing is actually a part of why I am not actually a huge fan of the early seasons of MASH, season 1 to 3, because there are a couple of episodes where sexual assault is played for laughs. And it's really, really bothersome to watch. And just this whole how they treated Margaret, and all the sexual humor just revolving around her. And it makes me uncomfortable, to be honest. So I'm glad that at this point it is a different Hawkeye in a little way, anyway, you know, because he backs off anyway, and that's good. He should do, of course. But, you know, he blows out the candle and turns off the music and is ready to talk about medicine, even though he doesn't really want to, of course. But it's at least a tiny step in the right direction for him. So that's something.
Yeah, Inga gets a great line where he hands her the drink and she sips it. She goes, "I love wine."
Yeah.
Pause. What is this?
Yeah, that's great. I love that we see a little bit of humor in her, so she isn't just this caricature. You know, it's a nice little side of her.
I thought that was really good. So finally, and by the way, I mean, I just, you know, the mechanics of the MASH unit. How do you romance somebody in a tent with the flaps up that anyone can see as you're walking.
Yes. Oh my goodness, do you just reach a point when it stops bothering you? And I honestly don't know. I would just not do well in those kinds of surroundings where there are constantly people around you. Oh my goodness. Oh, yuck.
Yeah, they literally have extras walking behind them yes. as they're talking. You can see. It's probably Goldman. It's always Roy Goldman going somewhere. Yeah. But yeah, it's just like, and of course, that's going to play into the episode later on because Margaret's going to make a comment about yes. that the whole camp knows that you failed. And so it's like, wow, everyone was yes. watching. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I should just warn you, Marie, that if you're not as big of a fan of the earlier seasons because of the sexual politics, the movie is going to be quite the whipsaw because the movie is even yes. rougher than the early seasons. So
I've heard that and I've seen some clips from the movie and I'm like, I don't think I want my MASH experience to be, tainted by the movie. Yeah. I'm sure it's great in its own way, but yeah, I think I'll skip it.
Yeah, it is, but it is also rough at the same time. So yeah. Now we cut to OR and everyone's working. And so Inga describes to Hawkeye that there is a procedure you can do on Hawkeye's patient where she's like, you build like a little shelf using some of the bone from the ileum. It's all this kind of medical talk. I really follow it. Yeah. I know what the ileum is, but that's about it. And it sounds none of them had ever been able to do it. And so she takes over from Hawkeye. Winchester comes over to watch. Potter comes over to watch. BJ says, I can't leave the table, but can you describe it? Which is great. That's great writing. Because that's, in any other show, you show, don't tell. You can't show this, obviously. So, okay, you're going to have her describe it for the audience, but also for BJ, which is great. And I will say, Marion Hartley has a real facility with medical terminology. There are times, yeah. I think, a lot of actors, when they're speaking, kind of deep cuts of, a job that they have to play, but are not that themselves. Sometimes it comes across like they're saying it almost phonetically because they clearly don't understand yeah. what they're saying. But she's got a real facility with it. It sounds very natural when she is describing this procedure.
It really does. I believe her every step of the way. And in this scene, I really like how open everyone is to this new procedure. Margaret is on it right away and Charles come over and Potter comes over and BJ again wants the narration. And, I really like that side of them. They are not set in their own ways. They're always open to learn something new.
Yeah. So later on we're in the mess tent and Winchester senses kind of the way Hawkeye sensed that Winchester was going to blow it with the Swedish lumpy women thing. And he prods Winchester into talking. Winchester senses that Hawkeye is a little upset and he starts prodding him and poking him. And initially Hawkeye just kind of, and then Winchester kind of keeps going. And then he picks at the scab enough that Hawkeye finally starts saying something dumb. And even BJ is a little like, oh boy. And then that sets off Margaret and she's like, look, you only judge women by one standard as long as they're cute and charming. And she says, you only give them by one standard. And then he says, sometimes not even that, which is really rough. Nasty, a pretty nasty thing to say.
And of course he would go there, that's such a Hawkeye Pierce thing to do. So of course, my dude, of course you would do that. Oh,
yeah. And then this spills off into the, it spills off onto the compound and they have this argument back and forth. And I like the scene. I like that Margaret is probably the only person that really could give Hawkeye this kind of talking to at this level. Yeah. She's just so unafraid of it. Not unafraid. That's not the right term. But like she is obviously she's not a wallflower. So she is going to, give Hawkeye this spiel. The only problem I have with it is when she talks about how basically, you think you're so desirable.
Yeah.
They did sleep together. That's the only thing. It reminds me of the thing, the writer Ken Levine, who was working on the show at this point, and he has talked about this on podcasts and on his own blog, that he was against that episode of them sleeping together because he said it's going to forever follow the characters. You can't unring that bell. And this is one of those moments where I'm like, well, okay, Margaret's protestations about how desirable Hawkeye is is a little thin considering she fell in love with him just a season ago.
Yes, I agree. But I also think that that whole comrade in arms thing was more of a temporary insanity on her part. And the whole sleeping together was just, you know, there's death over there and there's life over here. So let's do this life affirming activity to just save ourselves, you know. And I also think the whole thing of her being so extremely lovey-dovey the morning after there. I mean, Margaret is all about control. And I think in many ways that was the one thing she could control. She could control her emotions in having this new man in her life. And she could focus all of her attention on that. And if she did that, she didn't have to think of her imminent death or being caught and being raped and being killed. So it was more of a way of dealing with this horrible, horrible situation they were in than it was actually her falling for him. So, yeah. But I see what you mean there. And I mean, of course, this whole speech Margaret gives, we know that Margaret herself has made many, many mistakes when it comes to her own love life. She has ran around with married Frank Burns for God knows how long, and I am going to go ahead and assume that she didn't check for wedding rings on every finger of every general she wanted to sleep with. So, you know, she has made a lot of mistakes herself, and I just think this is an interesting step in her character development, that she has come to this point that she actually talks about women here, that she talks about how we live, we breathe, we dream, and it isn't about I feel this way because you treated me like this and it made me feel like this. So I like that. I like that she is at this point able to sort of lift her gaze from herself and talk about women. It's a good step for her, even though she, again, has made many, many mistakes and has truly a long way to go. But it's still good for you, Margaret, for having come to this point.
It's a terrific speech that you just quoted, that we live, we dream. Sometimes we have our little failures. We pick ourselves back up. It's a really terrific speech. And at one point, he even says to her, "You're raving," which is so cringy, you know, so cringy, because it's kind of like, oh, you're being hysterical. And you're like, oh, man, you know, oh, God.
Of course he would say that. Ah, my dude. And I also really like the scene with how it's framed, that the camera is over his shoulder when she's giving her speech there. It's just, he's so much taller than her, and he has this looming, brooding presence, and she just stands up too tall to the enemy here. And I think it's just a very aesthetically pleasing scene right there.
Mm. I love when they go back into the mess tent and Margaret gets a round of applause.
Yes! Listen to it. You know, it is a bit much, but I think it's fun too. And it's a small camp. Again, of course, everyone's going to hear exactly everything. And, you know, they step outside to talk, to have this private conversation in the middle of an open space where people are constantly coming and going. And there's like a flimsy tent wall separating you from everyone else. So it's not very private there.
I love, she literally says it's a small tent, Captain. Yes. A small camp, Captain. So it's a really terrific piece. And that's the act break of the episode. So then we come back and Inga returns to the swamp and we see that Hawkeye has softened quite a bit. And he says, you know, look, I read in this journal you've been doing some amazing work. And then she talks about that my father was a doctor and he told me to think of the patient first and courtesy second. And then he has this great response where he says, so did mine. You should have done what I would have done, which I think is great. I'm a sucker for Hawkeye talking about his dad, his dad's relationship, even though we never meet his father. It's one of the great, I think, TV father-son relationships. You know, they were able to,
yes.
to the way Alan Alda was able to sell it, you really get a feeling about Benjamin Pierce. And he just sounds like a great kind of dad. And I love that you could picture Benjamin Pierce instructing his young son, like, don't, you know, the patient is first, you know, courtesy comes second. It's just, I love that they threw that in.
Me too. I love that. I love every time Hawkeye talks about his dad or Crabapple Cove or anything. His eyes always get a little bit softer and his voice changes a little. And it's such a nice little detail to his, to the character of Hawkeye, that he has his home and his father as this, you know, beacon of joy in his life. It's great. I love it too.
Yeah, there's a warmth that comes across over Alan Alda's face and in his voice when he talks about, when Hawkeye talks about his dad, that it makes me think, you know, I mean, Alan Alda's a great actor. We don't, that's not news, but I have to think, this, like, is he channeling something in his own life where he's thinking of someone beloved to him? And that's what's informing his takes on when he has the character talking about this person that does not exist and we will never meet and we'll never even hear their voice, you know?
And it's weird with his father, because it really feels like we do know him, you know? Mm-hmm. Wasn't he on an episode? You know, I could swear he was, but no, of course he wasn't. No. It's a great character for being a character we never, ever see.
Yeah.
He is a great addition to the cast.
Yeah. So then, you know, Inga says, you know, by the way, the music and the candlelight, it was really quite sweet. Mm-hmm. And again, it's another wonderful piece of writing courtesy of Alan Alda, where it's okay, just because Inga wasn't ready for it 2 minutes after she pulled into the tent, the camp, it doesn't mean that she's not interested. And it doesn't mean that she might not be interested. It's just, you were just kind of going a little, you know, going a little guns blazing, Hawkeye.
Yes.
But now that I've had time to spend time with you, and I see that you're a great doctor, and she strokes his hands, and she says, "I notice your hands. You know, they're good. They're sensitive surgeon's hands." So she's actually interested in Hawkeye. And again, it's a nice, well-rounded character that it's like, look, just because I wasn't into it 2 minutes after I arrived, doesn't mean I'm not particularly interested in you now.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's a small camp, so I'm sure she has heard a lot of good things about this Dr. Pierce.
From all the nurses.
Yes. Many, many, many stories.
So then she kind of leans him over on the bed, and then he manages to come up with something even dumber than Winchester's lumpy Swedish women, where he says, "I have a question to ask you. When you go dancing, who leads?"
Yes.
And the look that comes across Inga's face is, I've occasionally seen that face. It's not good. Where you've completely ruined the moment. And I love that he realizes it in the moment, and she just gets up and leaves. And I just love that he goes, "I did it again. I did it again."
Hawkeye Pierce, ruiner of moments right there.
It's great. Like, I just come on, Hawkeye. What is your problem?
Yes. And this whole thing with Inga is also really interesting, actually, because again, I am not too fond of the romance part of this episode, but it is what it is. But it does bring me into the subject of the Swedish sin, because Inga really knows what she wants here and she goes for it. And Sweden has been, and I don't know if it still is actually, has been known for having more liberal views when it comes to sex. And this whole thing actually started back in the 50s when sex education in schools became mandatory. And this led a lot of people to believe that, you know, oh, the Swedish government is out there telling young people to have sex. And it was never about that. It was just about education and teaching young people about their bodies and about protection and about consent. And also during this era in the 50s, there were a bunch of movies who started to come out, which were a bit more risque than people were used to seeing up till this point. There were, you know, the occasional nudity, there was the occasional nipple every here and there. And there was sex was treated as a serious subject in these movies. They weren't pornos, but they were drama movies where sex was taken seriously. And this was also, people were not really used to seeing this, so it caused some controversy in the world, actually. And Sweden became this sort of symbol for sin and for moral decline. And this went on for a while. I read about this one sex ed movie that came out in the 60s that caused a lot of stir all over the world, as it seems. And there were protests, and there was one protest I read about held in London, and one of the protesters held up a sign that said, "Sweden, more pornography, more suicides, more alcoholism, and more gonorrhea every year." And I think that summed it up pretty well. It's also kind of an awesome slogan for a country, actually. We should just have stolen that and made it our
Yeah,
own.
that's
And
a hell of a
the
campaign promise to make.
exactly.
Jeez.
Why didn't we do that? Ah, gosh. And I also learned that this whole idea, this whole stereotype of a blonde, naughty woman named Inga from Sweden, it actually came from a movie called Maid in Sweden, maid as in housemaid. So I'm sure Charles would have loved the movie. And it came out in the early 70s, and it's about this country girl who leaves her rural home behind to go spend a weekend in Stockholm. And I can only assume that weekend involved romantic activities of some kind. I bet when Alan Alda wrote this episode and created this character, he had all of this in mind and made Inga be a very confident woman when it came to her sexuality. She knew what she wanted, and she wasn't afraid to go for it. And that's great. It's also kind of expected, I have to say, because when there is a female guest star on the show, they do tend to fall for the MASH man very, very easily. But it is what it is, and it's still good for Inga for going after what she wants, even though Hawkeye turned out to be a jerk once again.
Yeah, I mean, here in America, it's just we are obsessed with sex. We are just consumed by it, but then we are ashamed of it in equal measures. And so we sort of hate ourselves for being so obsessed with it. And it's like, well, just accept it. And then not to go down this road too far because we want to talk about the show, but like the whole argument about, well, if you introduce sex talk to, younger children, not young, like little kids, but younger children, you're enticing them into this, alternate lifestyle or whatever, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, have any of these people that protest this have ever had actual sex education? Because if there is, having had some when I went to school, there is nothing that makes sex sound less appealing than having a school teacher explain it to you. I mean, it is
Exactly.
it
It
is just the most
was
clinical, horrible. I don't want to hear my gym teacher explain to me women's ovulation. That is just the worst
horrible.
thing in the world. So the idea that somehow some teacher explaining it to you makes kids go like, oh boy, I want to get into it. It's just so contrary to any known reality that I'm familiar with. You're just like, all right, okay, these old blue noses, just calm down,
Yes, and remember seeing your teachers trying to talk about the subjects, and it was, oh yes, you just went, well, never gonna do that, that's for sure.
Oh, that sounds, yeah, it's just, yeah. So, yeah, that whole thing is, it's just absurd. And I have heard of Maid in Sweden, by the way. I've never seen it, but I have heard of it. I have heard of it. So, okay.
Nice.
So anyway, after Hawkeye flames out, has a sit down with Colonel Potter, who basically, this is kind of Colonel Potter's only scene in the episode.
Yes.
He's in the surgery scene, but he only has about one line to hear. He has a little heart-to-heart talk with Hawkeye, and he says, there's nothing wrong with taking your cue from the female of the species. And then he has this thing about the seahorse. The male gives birth to the babies, which is, I feel like, is that something Colonel Potter would even know? I feel like that the writer, Alan Alda, just kind of dropped that in there, but okay. But
Colonel Potter knows everything.
he really does. But he has this wonderful piece of wisdom where he says, just remember, There's a right way and a wrong way to do everything. And the wrong way is to keep trying to make everyone else do it the right way. And then he leaves. And you know, this guy, he's just perfect. You know?
Yeah.
Just perfect.
I know. I want a Colonel Potter in my life. Oh my goodness. I need someone to give me good advice like that on a daily basis. Please, Colonel Potter.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. You just really do. It's just really wonderful. So then BJ sits down and they start talking. And of course, you know, BJ has a very, very different perspective on relationships with women. Yeah. And he talks about that he and Peg are an equal partnership, and he would never have it any other way. You know, we took it for granted. We made our decisions together. While I'm here, she makes them without me. She picked up a piece of property back home. It's going to be worth a bundle in a couple of days. I love that. I like Peg Honeycutt, real estate shark.
Yes.
Good.
I love that. And I really like that BJ brings that up here, because he talks about how they were equal back home and made their decisions together. And as the show goes on, we will see how much it pains BJ to not be part of that duo anymore and not be part of the decision making and just be stuck across the world. And we will see how it affects him and just wears him down. So I like that that he mentions it here.
Yeah. So then as he gets up, he gets Klinger. Fine. You know, Klinger stops him and he says, you know, I heard what's going on and I want you to know I support you 100%. Men should be men, women should be women, and you start mixing them up and you won't, you know, you're going to get in all kinds of trouble. Now, on the one hand, I am a little troubled by Klinger's kind of reactionary old school politics. But of course, the whole point is the absurdity of where it's coming from as he's standing there dressed like that and he's making this speech. But I don't know. Klinger, I expected a little more from you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's usually very, very open, and it's a bit weird, but the contrast is very funny with the hat and the earrings and everything. So I'll allow it.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to make a point. He runs into Father Mulcahy. Hawkeye runs into Father Mulcahy. Even Father Mulcahy, he gets a ding in, which is the kind of Father Mulcahy he's only seen in the episode, basically.
Yeah. But I love how sassy he is there. You know, he's so happy with himself with a little joke he made there. He's like,
yeah. He's entertaining himself. He worked on that line, you know, before he read it. Hawkeye, he kind of workshopped it in his mind. So then in post-op, Winchester is showing Dr. Halverson various patients. By the way, Dr. Halverson has a tie on. Is that a thing? Like, that seems a little unusual. Was that what women would wear back then? Or is that a Swedish thing? It just seems a little unusual that she would have a tie. I mean, even the men are wearing ties, and yet she's got a tie on.
I don't know, actually. I don't think it's a Swedish thing anyway.
Okay.
It's not a common thing here. So maybe it's just a fashion choice.
Maybe so. So anyway, as they're walking around, one of Winchester's patients starts convulsing and they react. And Winchester says, you know, something must be lodged in the trachea. And there's a little bit of business here where, by the way, the patient is an actor named Mark Favara. This is his single acting credit. I never understand that. I don't understand how you can kind of get into acting, land one of the most popular shows on television, and then never do another thing after that. I don't know how that career trajectory works.
Like,
you know, you would think having MASH on your resume would get you a BJ and the Bear or What's Happening or a Lou Grant or something, but nope, this is it. That's it for him.
That's weird. Oh, well.
Yeah. So Winchester asks the nurse for get me an emergency tray. I'll do a tracheotomy. Yes. And then we hear Inga say, we don't have to cut him open. Get me an IV adrenaline. And they start arguing. And the nurse is, we see the nurse in the background and she's preparing, she's preparing the tray. And we see that she is spending time doing the IV first.
Yes.
And then then Winchester notices and he says, you know, I asked for a cardiac tray, but she has it in her hand. So she's able to do both simultaneously. But I love the sort of fire that David Ogden Stiers brings to it. We can tell that he's really annoyed at the nurse for doing that.
Absolutely. And I love an earlier reaction from that nurse when she's sitting on the bed tending to the patient, and Charles is talking to Inge and says that, oh, you know, the penicillin was administered in time. Very good work, my dear. And she makes a little face and rolls her eyes. And I love that. I love that she is over Dr. Winchester, you know, is being so condescending. And then later on, when the patient is in trouble, Charles calls Inga, my dear. He doesn't say doctor. And I find that.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. He calls her my dear. And that sort of shows us where he truly feels Inga is on the, you know, professional ladder. She's still a couple of steps beneath him. You know, she's not a doctor. She's a my dear in this moment. So it's a nice little detail there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's funny. I didn't even notice that. So. Yeah. It works. Inga's procedure works. And then Winchester, you know, dripping with contempt, says,
yes.
You know, I would be grateful for what you showed me. That you, it looks like you were right. And I was wrong. And he walks out and they hold on Inga and she just looks crestfallen. Cause you're like, oh, you know, man.
Yes.
Like this visit for her has not been fun.
No, why did I come? Oh my God.
Can I move on to the 863rd? Like this is,
yes,
this is pretty
please
rough stuff.
Get me out of here. But I love David Ogden Stiers acting in that moment. It's so good. You can just see how much pain he is in, you know, when he has to say that you were right and I were wrong. It's like his whole body just tenses up and it's like those shards of glass in his throat. And oh, I love watching him. I love watching him in every scene. He's one of my favorite actors on the show. And it just embodies Charles 100% all the time and is so completely honest about his acting and so dedicated to the character. And it's always just such a joy to watch.
And then he gets a blow up back at the swamp where he
yes.
is ranting and raving to Hawkeye and BJ about the way that she stood, you know, sort of showed him up. And then he says,
yes.
and that underhanded little nurse, which is,
yes.
oh,
yep.
He's really letting the mask slip here.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this scene in particular may be a big reason as to why people aren't really a fan of this episode, because it is uncomfortable to see Charles just rage like this and saying all these things. And, you know, if this had been Frank, if this had been an early episode and Frank would still have been there, I think people's reaction would have been a lot different, because we are used to Frank always being the worst. So of course he would have been super upset about that woman, you know, but when it's Charles, who is this much more complex character, and we are used to actually being able to side with him a lot, and we know that he is a great doctor and he has a sense of humor, and you know, he is all these things that Frank wasn't. It just makes it, the whole scene just hits differently when it's Charles.
Yeah. And then Hawkeye says, you know, gee, seeing you, Charles, spout your bilge, which is a great term,
yeah.
Spout your bilge.
Yeah.
I'm getting a picture of the world's most perfect ass. And he says, yes. Are you referring to me? No, I'm referring to me. And he gets up and walks out. And Winchester's like, well, I'm glad he got that right. And of course, BJ with the little stinger, don't feel bad, Charles. You're just as perfect.
Yes, I love here in this episode too that Hawkeye again just sits back and, you know, watches Charles being this, letting all these horrible things fall out of his mouth. And he just has to see his own behavior filtered through Charles, and even, you know, Margaret's words filtered through Charles for them to actually affect him. It's a nice little detail.
Yeah, I love it. And then when he's walking to Inga's tent, I love that he runs across Margaret and he's like, I love the way you told off Winchester. And she's like, I did what? He's like, keep up the good work. And he just keeps walking. And she just,
yes.
The hell is he talking about?
It's so good, because these two characters obviously do respect each other so much as professionals and as human beings at this point. And they have this way of actually calling each other out and, you know, picking up the pieces. And but they both suck at actually communicating emotions. So he can't just say that, yeah, I heard what you said and you were right. He has to do it in this backwards way by referring to Charles. And it's great. A very, very Hawkeye thing to do.
Yeah. So he shows up at Inga's tent, and Merritt Hartley really sells it, because when she answers the door, her shoulders are slumped. Her arms are kind of just dangling limply on her sides, because she is wounded. She is really, and she's not wounded at what Winchester said. It's that he reacted the way she did. And she's sort of like, why am I being stopped from being the best doctor possible because of this? And she's just utterly despondent. And it's a great, and you feel really bad for it. She seems like such a nice person that, and she's like, you know, why do men do that? What are we supposed to, boy, let him cut into him for no good reason.
Yes.
And Hawkeye is there to say, no, you did the right thing. You know, it's what I would have done. Yeah. And it's a really terrifically warm scene, because we see that she's been fairly stoic throughout the episode, but here we can see what really hurts her is the idea that she would be stopped from being the best possible doctor because of some other, you know, ridiculous reason.
Absolutely. And it's obviously not the first time for her that she has stepped on some frail Mentos, you know, and it must really wear you down for sure.
Yeah. So then they do this dance where she wants to show him this Swedish dance. Is this a thing? Are you familiar with this dance?
You know, yeah, I am. I tried to find out what song this was, but I couldn't find it anywhere. But I do believe that the dance is called a hottis. You go 1, 2, 3, hold, 1, 2, 3, hold, and then you spin around. And it is this Swedish folk dance. And, you know, Swedish folk dancing is crazy hard because you spin around a lot. And it's just a crazy, dangerous thing to do in a tiny little tent. It really is. But it's a cute scene. And I really like that Hawkeye says that the melody is both funny and sad at the same time, because that is the svenska vemod, the Swedish melancholy for you right there.
Right. It goes back to what you were talking about. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Something can be very sweet and kind of fun, but it also has this tone of sadness to it.
So after a couple attempts, you know, that he won't let her lead. He just inherently won't let her lead. And then she finally points it out. And then he kind of, you know, like relaxes a little. They do this turn, as you say, they turn like 5 times, which is like, like they're dizzy. And it works. And so they laugh and they're like, oh, okay, you finally see this can work. Yeah. And then they hear wounded are arriving, and he says, well, we'll only be busy for 10 to 12 hours.
Yeah, that's nothing.
10 to 12, piece of cake. We can do that. That's fine. We'll get right back to it afterwards. And then she says, no, I have to go in another 5 or 6.
Yeah.
I've been assigned to the Norwegian hospital ship for tomorrow afternoon. The Norwegian hospital ship. What's that? Yeah. That sounds like fun. I didn't know the Norwegian had a navy, but okay.
Me neither, but go Norway.
I can't believe I just said Norwegia. Norway. I know that Norway is Norwegian is the country. Oh, God's
sakes. Oh my God, they're going to be so mad at you now.
Yeah. If we have any listeners in Norway, please don't write angry emails. I'm dumb sometimes. I apologize.
Oh my God. This whole scene just, I don't know. This is part of why I'm not a fan of the romance in this episode, because everything just feels a bit clumsy. I mean, in every meaning of the word. We find out that Hawkeye realizes that he doesn't have to be the leader in a relationship or in the OR, and that's great, you know. And Inga is just so very forward with him, you know. She's so when she places his hands where they should be, and you know, it's like, okay, she is a very hands-on, forceful character, and we get it. It's just, I feel that everything is a bit on the nose here, to be honest. And I feel like MASH usually is, when MASH is at its best, I think it's a lot more subtle than this scene, but you know, it's fine for what it is. But if I could have my wish come true, I would have skipped the romance, and instead of this scene, I would have loved to see a scene with Inga and Margaret and some of the nurses just, you know, sitting down and having dinner or just talking, you know, some female bonding would have been really nice here. Just talking about their experiences of being women in this very male dominated world and in this crazy, terrifying, dangerous place. It would have been a great moment. And MASH, we don't see a lot of moments like that in MASH with women just talking. And it would have been a great opportunity, but they went a different route. And for what it is, it's fine.
Yeah, it occurs to me, you're right, that Loretta Swit and Mayor Hartley do not have any scenes together. They're in the operating room together, but they don't really exchange any lines. Yeah, they don't have a single scene together. Yeah.
Their characters really do have a lot in common. I mean, they are very serious about their careers. Margaret as a major and Inga as a surgeon, and their fathers seem to have a big played a big part in their lives. So we know that for sure with Margaret, and Inga mentions her father too. And it would have been an awesome scene to just have women talking and not talk about men for a while. That would have been nice.
This episode of MASH does not pass the Bechdel test, as they say.
Nope, it doesn't.
I will say the one group of people that did not agree with your assessment, Marie, is the Emmys. Because this show won Alan Alda an Emmy for writing.
It did. And good for him. For what it is a very well-written episode. So I'm all for it.
And also not to take anything away from the win, but I think a lot of times when, I mean, they have to submit the way Emmys work. The show has to submit particular episodes for consideration. But I always feel like TV shows, those are kind of accumulated awards. You know, I feel like it's always like, oh, Alan Alda's written a bunch of great MASHes. Let's give him an Emmy. Again, not to take away from him at all. In fact, if anything, it's. But I do think it's, you know, it's one thing when you give an Oscar for a movie because it's a one off ostensibly. But when you're giving someone a director, an actor, or a writer for a TV show, you can't help but think of all the great episodes in the back of your mind, and you say, "Oh, let's give them right." So, okay, Alan Alda's written a lot of great MASHes that he never even got nominated for.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, why not? I mean, you know, he wrote Dear Sigmund, for Pete's sake. Like, that deserves like every Emmy possible. So, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it ends with them going off to surgery, and we hold on the record playing the sad Swedish song, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
A nice little touch, you know, to kind of end it with that of the melancholy of lost opportunity, that this could have been something really great, and Hawkeye just blew it because he just isn't, he was not as capable. Emotionally as he would be now. So
yes, he's not at that point yet, sadly. Mm-hmm.
So then we come back, and it's a scene with Margaret and Hawkeye, which is nice because they've been kind of at each other's throats throughout the episode.
Yep.
So it's kind of nice that the things have kind of cooled down a little, and she says, you know, the movie's playing in the mess tent, and he says it's Casablanca, and she's like, with Humphrey Bogart, and he says, and Ingrid Bergman, of course. It's famous Swedish. Now I gotta say, we've been treated to the history of bad MASH movies that the 477 gets. Casablanca, though, that's about as good as it's going to get. So good for them that they finally got a decent movie as opposed to the one of my favorites, which is the Field Pack, Your Canvas Buddy, you know, all these horrible movies.
Oh, you know, Foot Fungus or something. Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how they managed to get Casablanca this time, but, you know, hey, it's pretty good stuff.
Awfully big coincidence, but fine.
Yeah, that would be funny if they had gotten, well, they couldn't have gotten made in Sweden because it wasn't out yet, but they could have.
That would have been amazing.
So he doesn't want to go, and then Margaret basically says, no, come on, I'll buy you popcorn. And it ends with them quoting, Louis, this is the start of a beautiful friendship, quoting Casablanca. And that's the end of our episode. So that's Inga.
Yes. And oh, I love this. I love this little last scene with Hawkeye and Margaret. It's so sweet. And just this, that the energy between them is so very different this time around than their last scene out in the compound. And just how it's shot, you know, that he's sitting down and sort of leaning back, and she's crouching down to talk to him at his level, and you know, not standing up, yelling at an enemy here. And I really love that, and I really like that. By the end, when they walk out, and Hawkeye quotes Casablanca there, that again, he is not able to tell Margaret that, thank you for being a good friend and for being there for me. He has to quote the movie, and of course, Hawkeye has to do that because he sucks at actually expressing his real emotions, and so does Margaret, of course. And it's just, I love that they have this relationship at this point when they can, you know, call each other out at their worsts and be there to pick up the pieces, and that Margaret insists that he comes with her and watches the movie. It reminds me of the scene in Images when Margaret is upset over the dog, and Hawkeye insists that she talks about it. She they won't give up on each other, and I think that's just really, really nice.
I think it's even in the season two episode, Bless You, Hawkeye. No, not Bless You, Hawkeye. That's later on. I think it's the one where Hawkeye has to, I'm blanking on the title of it, the one where he has to, he's the only surgeon there because everyone gets sick, and him and Margaret are running the operation. And
Carry
there's a
on,
bit.
Hawkeye.
Carry on, Hawkeye. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I can't believe I blanked on that. But there's a moment where he quotes another movie and she says, "Why are you like this?" And I like that. I like that there are people who use movie quotes. And by the way, when I say there are people, I'm raising my hand, guilty, that use movie and TV quotes as a way of expressing themselves as opposed to saying something direct. And for some people, that can be like, why? What are you doing? You know, and so, but that's a crutch that I use. And so I appreciate that Hawkeye's like that. And he's like, yeah, he's kind of deflecting a little bit of like, so, you know, he's not saying directly what he wants, but he's using this, like, okay, I'll sort of safely couch this in a line from the movie that we both know.
Yes, exactly. And Margaret, of course, knows what he means, and she gives a little giggle as they walk out, and it's very sweet.
Yeah. It's a sweet episode. So, okay, Marie, do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
Oh my goodness. As much as I do love Charles talking about lumpy Swedish women, that is always very, very funny to me. I have to go with Margaret's whole speech ending with the soggy piece of liver. Oh my goodness. It's one of my favorite things of the entire 11 seasons. So definitely that.
Let me tell you, Buster, we can go into that tent and replace you with a soggy piece of liver. Boom, slams the door.
So good.
It is, it's a good, again, it's a great speech. My favorite bit is actually, by the way, there's no Radar in this episode. He's not in this
No, it
episode
isn't.
at all. Yeah, another Gary Berghoff got another week off. My favorite line actually comes from Father Mulcahy in his one scene where we kind of danced around it a little bit earlier, where he says, "Well, you know, Hawkeye," he says, "basically, I'm supposed to teach you to avoid sin." And he goes, "But you seem to be avoiding it just fine." Such a
And he's so
burn.
happy. He's so happy with himself up there. It's so sweet.
It's like, oh man, like there's a scene in there's a Simpsons once where Bart is so Bart Simpson starts going through something and he becomes so unpopular that even the nerd kid Martin makes a joke on Bart's at Bart's expense and gets a laugh, and Bart gets frustrated and he goes, "Man, even Martin is dumping on me." And it's like that's how low he is sunk that even Martin is getting one off on him. And so it's like that's how bad things are going when the one guy in the camp who doesn't have sex is dunking on you for not getting laid. Oh man. So I
Oh
just,
my goodness.
yeah, William Christopher makes the most of the little bit that he's given in this episode. So.
Absolutely, he really does. And that's what I love about these types of episodes without a strong A and B plot where everyone is involved in the same thing, that everyone truly grabs onto what little screen time they get and just makes the absolute most out of it. It's great.
It really is. So, well, Marie, thank you so much for doing this. You have been just really one of the delights of the comment section on the website. I always look forward to your comments because again, they're always highly entertaining, well thought, very funny. You know, self-mocking sometimes. You make fun of yourself in the comments, which is always appreciated. And so, this was I'd always hoped to get you on the show, and boy, this is lined up perfectly having this episode. And so I hope you come back. I would love to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're very welcome. So, and thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of our show on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, where I expect you, Marie, to leave a comment on this episode that you're on. Just because you're in the
I
episode does
will.
not exempt you from leaving a comment on it. You can go to Twitter, follow the show there, MASH477Cast. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, please go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Adam Ackerman, Dennis Bailey, Dean Baer, Russell Burbage, Darrell Clark, Tim English, Charles Allen Gassard, James K., Michael Kelly, Lisa P., Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Nicholas Prom, Billy Shulman, Mike Thomas, Daniel Ulrich, and Stefan Van Schaik. So thank you all very much. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. But until then, that is all.